What's up, martial artists? Welcome to Black Belt, a martial arts lifestyle podcast. I'm your host, Harinder Singh, and we're going to bridge the gap between sport, tradition, and reality. Join me as I sit down with world-class practitioners to discuss their lifestyles, to teach you about their mindset, training, and fighting methods so that we can grow from their wisdom. My guest this episode is the pitmaster, John Hackelman, who is one of the most sought-after trainers in MMA history. He is the founder of the world-famous Pit Martial Arts and Fitness, which is the home to UFC champions Chuck Liddell and Glover Teixeira. The Pitmaster's unique approach is catered to children, adults, and professional fighters. His Hawaiian Kempo curriculum is designed to address schoolyard bullying, dangerous street assaults, and professional cage fighting. My key takeaway is that peak physical conditioning directly impacts mental performance. I believe the Pitmaster is a creative genius when it comes to preparing his fighters for world-class competition. His innovative training methods are designed to replicate the pressures and stresses of combat. In this episode, we discuss physical and mental conditioning, what it takes to prepare world-class athletes, and how to lead with confidence, loyalty, and humility. Well, hello, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Black Belt. I'm your host, Harinder Singh. Today I have with me, I have the Pitmaster, John Hackelman. Sir, it's a great honor to have you on board.
Hey, thanks. I love being here. Love it. Love it.
So I've been waiting for this podcast because, you know, we've had a few chances to meet back and forth in Vegas and the super shows and finally get a chance to sit down and pick your brain. For those of you who don't know, Coach John is the instructor of the legendary Chuck Liddell, and currently Glover Teixeira is one of the top five light heavyweights, right, sir?
Yes.
Top five light heavyweights in the world, and he has an extensive background in Kempo, Hawaiian Kempo, along with MMA and boxing, and so we're going to get into a great conversation today. And I want to start off with, man, you guys are known for that legendary left hook, man. Tell me all about that, where that came into being.
I'm known for it just because I love it. But to be honest, like, Chuck's biggest punch was a straight right. Glover has a perfect left hook, a beautiful overhand right. But he's a little more well-known for his great takedowns and vicious groundwork. Then I got Jason Von Flew, who created the Von Flew choke, which is all over now. I got Tim Kennedy, who's known for being the world. I mean, he's like 007. I mean, he's like Army Ranger, Green Beret, MMA fighter. He's like 007 James Bond. And then we got, you know, Court McGee, who's known for just his tenacity and his unbelievable conditioning. And I love the left hook. So I push the left hook so much because it's my favorite strike in all of martial arts. And I think my first fight I won with a left hook. I was 14, and that's a fight in the ring, boxing. And it's just always been my favorite strike. But I think it's the most efficient, effective, safe strike to throw in all of martial arts. So I love the left hook. Some of my guys don't really don't follow along with me as much because they like their own thing. And one thing as an instructor, I don't want to push my stuff on everybody. Like when I'm training Chuck, I don't want to say, no, more left hooks when he's landing that right hand over and over. I don't want to tell Glover, no, don't take him down. Throw the left hook more, you know. So everybody has their what they love to do. So I try to make their thing better, not make them adapt to my mold. But I do love the left hook. I love the left hook.
So, you know, you said a few very interesting things there. You know, I think one of the things is that I admire about you and that I notice is that all your fighters, like you mentioned, they fight differently. So as a coach and as a teacher, how do you cultivate that? Because sometimes what ends up happening is, you know, the teacher's influence influences the fighter too much. Like, you got to fight like me. You got to do my style the way my style is. But you seem to be able to get the best out of your fighters? And like, were you always like that? How did you develop that or think of that? You know, if you could tell me a little bit about that.
I think I started like, I want everybody to be just like me. And I realized quickly in my coaching career that not everybody's going to be like me. And a lot of people are going to be better than me. Like the, you know, I mean, when I used to spar with Chuck, I used to hit him all the time and say, you got to block that left hook. He's like, I can't, you know, and then, you know, I get mad at him because every time I hit him, I got mad at him. And then all of a sudden, wait, he was blocking more and hitting me more. And I was like, damn it. So then all of a sudden he's just running through me. So it's like, you sometimes the student becomes the instructor, and a lot of my takedown defense that we have incorporated into the pit, you know, I got from Chuck. A lot of my great grappling has come from, you know, Ricardo Laborio, Cesar Gracie, you know, some of the best jiu-jitsu guys in the world. So I take from them, and I realize striking isn't always the best because I've been taken down by the likes of, you know, Matt Lindland and Sammy Henson, Olympic wrestlers. And I realized, dang, I'm not very effective off my back. So I got to escape. So I worked with Mario Sperry, you know, Laborio, how to get off my back, you know, in a fight. So all of a sudden I realized there's so many other things besides what I love to do. And my guys, like watching Glover fight, I'm not going to change his style. I mean, it's been working for him from the beginning. So I just try to make his style better. So by doing that, it is more difficult because now I got to learn more stuff. I can't just only do the left hook and the burpee, left hook and burpees, you know, because I have to be more dimensional like that. Or I become what I put other people down for. I become a partial artist instead of a martial artist.
I love that.
You know, so yeah. To me, if you don't, oh, you know, if you don't embrace all of the different arts, and you don't have to specialize in them, but if you don't embrace them all and acknowledge that each one has their place, you're a partial artist and not a martial artist, and shame on you.
What do you think keeps people away from that discovery process?
Comfort zone. Like you saw it in the beginning with the Gracies. I mean, you know, they come on. I love the Gracies, you know, and they're the ones that opened everybody's mind to what really works. But then kind of halfway through that, you know, they didn't really grow. They did the same thing, and, you know, they didn't, all of a sudden they weren't, you know, their stuff wasn't as effective because everyone else, you know, hybrid their system, and they didn't. They were too much into just the jujitsu, and now obviously everybody's into everything, and I think that's, you, if you don't get out of your comfort zone, and you're not going to grow. But with that said, everybody has specialties. You know what I mean? I mean, Dan Henderson is an Olympic level wrestler, right? But he's known for that H bomb. He liked to throw that right hand, and he made millions of dollars with it. He won multiple titles with it. And if you watched him, anyone that watches him fight and didn't know his history would think he's just a brawler. They didn't know he was an Olympic level wrestler. He just liked to throw that right hand. So you got to go outside your comfort zone if you want to become a successful martial artist.
That's wonderful. And I think something that maybe keeps people away from that is sometimes, you know, like you said, when you have to go outside of your comfort zone, as Master Hicks and Gracie always said, you have to make yourself comfortable in uncomfortable situations, which is, you know, what fighting is all about, because we can't control our opponent and what's going to happen. But we know for sure it's going to be uncomfortable, that we're inside of this chaos. And how do you help people, you know, get to that still point, that place of being calm and finding that zone in the chaos? Because, you know, stepping into a cage, or whether you're attacked on the street, that mental impact of the chaos is something that overwhelms people, and they get into the fight and flight, and sometimes they freeze, they you know, they don't know how to move, they don't know what to do. How do you train your fighters to get over that?
The fighters, and I have three different student base. It's my sport fighters. It's my street fighters, which are my regular students. When I say street fighting, I mean stay alive on the street. You're not like challenging guys in a street fight. It's staying alive in the street, and it's my kids, and that's schoolyard domination or anti-bullying. And they're not going, it's not as life or death, it's more get the bully to quit bullying you. It's different. Then you got the adults, it is life or death. It's life or death. And you have to treat it as such, because if you don't, you know, it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And then my fighters, they want to win a title. They want to win the UFC title. That's it. And it's a different mindset for each one, but it's the same at the same time. It's really hard, intense, out of your comfort zone, anaerobic type training, which isn't fun. It's not like a little jog on the beach. It's pushing yourself and your heart rate all the way in a combat-like situation. And it's hard to do that because you can't spar your way into shape. Yes, you can't. And a lot of people think they can. And you can't, because you're going to be hurt all the time. If you're sparring that hard all the time where you're trying to get your heart rate up, which you have to do regularly as a martial artist, then you're getting hit really hard and you're getting brain damage, cuts, etc. And if you grapple that hard all the time, you're getting your arm popped, you're getting your knee popped. It's not conducive to longevity. So we want to train smart when you're training with a partner, but we also want to push your heart rate. And it's hard to do that. It takes a lot of creativity to get my guy's heart rate up really high like they will in a fight, without letting them get the heck beat out of them in sparring. So doing that's one of the things that takes creativity as a coach or as an instructor. You have to think of ways to put your people in predicaments. And the more you put them in these very uncomfortable predicaments, there goes the confidence. There goes the mindset. The best way to prepare yourself mentally for a fight is to know that you are physically prepared for that fight. The more physically you're prepared for the fight, your mental preparation goes up at the same time. Because now you say, gee, I'm in great shape and I'm ready for this fight. You know, walking down the street, I feel that way when I walk into, you know, if I walk into a bar, I walk into a party, whatever, I always know I've been training. I know I have that mental preparation. I feel mentally prepared at all times. And then for my fighters, it takes you mentally prepare them in camp so that they peak mentally and physically prepared. Because if you keep a sport fighter, always physically prepared for their cage fight, then they're gonna overtrain very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's like if you sharpen a knife over and over nonstop, pretty soon that's going to be dull again. Yes, sir. So you have to peak them. So it's a little bit different. And then for the kids, you just want to give them confidence all the time. And it has to be more about fun. So there's three different ways, but they're all the same, but they're all different. That was so confusing. No, I don't even understand what I just said.
No, I'm confused.
Right now.
No, man, that's spot on. So with regards to, like, let's start with the sport fighters there and go a little deeper into that. What are some techniques or drills or things that you like to do to get them into that zone where the heart is pumping, where, you know, they have to make the decision to breathe and calm themselves down? And you know, I'm assuming you're giving them repetitions and repetitions of that, where you increase the chaos, increase the tension, and yeah, then they slow down, calm down, and build the capacity. What's some things you like to do for that?
Oh, one of them, without a doubt, and I've been doing this for years, and all my fighters know it, I call it R&R, rowing and wrestling. Okay. I row them with a sprint, uh-huh, like a 100-meter sprint. They have to do X amount of calories or X amount of meters in a short burst of time. So I know it's like super hard. And then they get off the rower right away on their back, and somebody mounts them and starts pounding them.
Nice.
Right off the rower. So we call it R&R, rowing and wrestling, and we've been doing it. Then they start wrestling, and then all of a sudden, boom, back in the rower, boom, back on the mat. That's one of my favorites. Another one is just burpees and anything. Like, I'll have my guys do burpees, bag, and then get on the bottom. Or burpees, get on the bottom, and then spar as hard as you can to the body. You know, because I don't ever want them to go hard as you can, full on everywhere. Or like I said, they're going to get hurt more than they're going to get in shape. So it's a really hard, it's a balance. And people say, well, if you don't hit them in the face as hard as they can, they're never going to get used to getting hit in the face. Well, if you really believe that, then how, as a knife fighter, how are you going to know how to knife fight if you don't get stabbed?
Yes.
I'll tell you why, because you don't want to get hurt, and you have to have a kind of, you have to be tough and old school, but you have to be a little bit smart too, or you're going to create a bunch of, you know, brain damaged fighters.
Yes, sir. What's your thoughts on sprinting, and do you incorporate sprinting and road work with your guys?
Yeah, that's a certain day, and it's a different workout. Sometimes you just got to get out there and like blow out the engine, you know, just blow that car out as hard as you know, as fast as you can. They always say, yeah, take it out and blow out the cam or whatever. Sometimes you just get out on the beach and we just, you know, just do a sprint. It's harder to do sprints and something like running sprints because it's just, you don't, you know, like in a gym, it's hard to do that. We do that on the treadmill where we'll do 10 and 10 sprints. And then do something combative like bag work or something, but most of our sprints involve something stationary so we can be right here.
Yes, sir.
It's like burpees or four punches in a sprawl or Glover sprawls, something that gets our heart rate up. Or we go into the other room and we do Airdyne. Yeah. Right, the Airdyne is the hardest. If you just had to pick one thing that is the most painful when it comes to physical conditioning and getting your heart rate up. And it's an old wrestling, you know, Olympic wrestlers use this, and that's, you know, they're known for their conditioning. The Airdyne bike, the old school Schwinn Airdyne, just going, you know, that bike that has the handles and the pedals, and just have a coach like me yelling at them that they got to get the number up to RPM, a certain RPM, and then boom, a short break. You always want to give them short breaks. It has to be interval because the fight is an interval, and they have to know how to get their heart rate down. When you back up and you start jabbing, you guys learn how to get your heart rate down, and then all of a sudden it's engagement again. And then even more than that, when the bell rings, they got a minute. You got a minute as a coach to get their heart rate down and get their breathing right, and then give them a little bit of you know, like strategy before they go back to the next round. So doing that is part of the way we train. Like, we train, then we give them a short break, and they have to get used to doing that. But that's – I do sprint my guys. That was a long answer to a specific question, and I do that a lot. That's one reason my wife's in the other room right now, not in here. But I do sprints, but we don't do that daily like I used to when I was fighting. That was it. It would be our road work, bag work, and sparring were pretty much it in my boxing days. And then now, even that Alex Pereira, who's training with Glover now, he's the best kickboxer in the world. He knocked out Israel Asancha in kickboxing, and he's coming into the UFC. But he's so successful. But he just runs, hits the bag, and spars. He doesn't do all the crazy stuff that we do because this has worked for him.
Yeah.
If it ain't broke with my fighters, I'm really big on that. If it ain't broke, I'm not, you know, there's nothing to fix. So if my fighter has been doing something and it's been working for him, I'm definitely going to say, no, I know better. Do it my way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that because everybody's different, right? We all have different fingerprints. We're all different fighters and have unique talents and training methods. And to have a coach that can come in and direct us instead of changing the direction is I think, a a very profound ability. Now, I wanted to ask you something. So, you know, for the listeners listening, what you had said earlier was quite profound, and it's a great understanding, I think, for a lot of martial artists and even athletes to have. So if I hear you correctly, you burn out your athlete, you burn out the martial artist, you put them into this state of chaos. But the key thing was that then they have that moment of recovery. So you're doing all that to teach them to actively recover and make decisions, because that is where everything is going to go wrong. So they're learning to operate in that state, right? Is that, if I heard you correctly?
Yeah. Yeah. And I can think of one right now, one of my guys right now, he just had one gear, and that was just burn out. And when it worked, it really worked for him. But when it didn't, he would crash, because nobody can sprint 26 miles. Mm. You know what I mean? That's why sprinters, if Usain Bolt, the sprinting champion from Jamaica, I think that's the way you say his name. Yeah. But if he ran the same pace in the marathon he does in his, you know, 100 meters, he'd finish the marathon in like an hour, right? And if a marathon runner, you know, who we think is pretty fast, I could never run a marathon in 2 hours and 3 minutes or whatever. But if they ran that same pace for a sprint, you know, a 100-meter sprint, they would never even, you know, be in the top 10,000 in the world for sprinters. It's two different things. And sometimes people like to, you know, think they're the same, and they're not. Nobody can sprint a prolonged sprint. If, like I said, if they could, Usain Bolt would be able to do 26 miles at that same pace. You can't do that. It's physically impossible. So I like my guys to sprint to their maximum and then be able to relax. Sometimes you're clinching, you take a breather, you know, as much as you can. Or sometimes you're on the bottom or the top. There's some guys on the bottom, they can relax on the bottom and stay safe. We got four priorities on the bottom. Number one is to stay safe, because if you're trying to escape, right, which is number two priority, while somebody else is punching you in the face and you're not protecting yourself, you'll be knocked out. You won't have to escape, because now you're dead. Yeah. Okay, so you have to protect yourself from the bottom first, then you have to escape, okay? And then you attack. So you got to go and you have to prioritize that. And some guys are so good on the bottom, they can relax. They can hang out there and get a really good rest down there. Okay, some guys can relax in the cage, against the cage in a clinch. Some guys can't. They get really hyper there. So you have to find out where you can relax, and you have to go to that place. A lot of guys who are more stand-up based, they like to relax at a farther distance, and they can throw some jabs, take some deep breaths, get the heart rate down a little bit, and then boom, back into the battle. So yeah, everybody should train their anaerobic threshold. That's very important, but they should also train their rest and when they can, you know, how to get the heart rate down, because that's a big skill that's very important. You got a minute in between rounds to get your fighter's heart rate down, his breathing right, and then give him a little bit of a strategy. And another thing in the corner, guys, if you're a corner guy, if your guy's hurt and he says, oh, I can't see out of my such and such eye, stop the fight. If your fighter says, I can't see out of my eye, he's too tough, he's going to go out there blind. Yeah. Okay? You got to be the guy to stop the fight. If he can't, if you see that he's getting the crap kicked out of him and he has no chance of winning and he's hurt, stop the fight, please, guys. Please. Don't always leave it up to the referee or the fighter. The fighter's too tough to know. He doesn't know better. He's just going to fight till he dies. It's your job as a corner man to say, you know what? This is my guy. I care about him. He's had enough. Bing. I want him to fight another day. So that's another – I just threw that in.
No, I respect that. You know, because as the coach, you're responsible for their safety. And like you said, they're warriors. They're going to go in there and let it all out. With the complexity of mixed martial arts, or if you look at even you know, even in a street fight, for example, right? If we take an example of Alex, who's training with you now to get ready for the UFC, you have somebody who's a world champion kickboxer, and he's amazing at his striking and his conditioning. For the rule set of kickboxing, is going to be something that is going to be a little different than, for example, okay, all the way over here, you may have somebody who's jiu-jitsu or grappling competition, and his will be, again, a different conditioning set that's going to have to happen there. But in MMA, it's quite fascinating because, you know, sometimes you see a fight and it looks like it's just kickboxing the whole time. Other times it goes to the ground. Then there's the changes. So those changes in tension and pressure from going from striking to the clinch to the ground to escaping and then getting pounded on the ground and getting back up, that's like a – it's like a wave that is very hard to kind of classify. And so, you know, how do you get the person ready for that, that change in those tensions?
Because we do, like that drill I was telling you about, which we have a bunch, and a lot of it's freestyle stuff. When you do freestyle stuff, you got to watch it because they're going one way and the other guy is going, you know, one guy's going one guy one way and the other guy's going the other way. Almost all of our injuries come from grappling, almost all of them. Our jiu-jitsu class has 100 times more injuries than our stand-up class. And when my MMA guys are training, even if it's a cut, I go, it happened during wrestling because their heads come together or an elbow. They're reaching over here and a guy jumps in and he hits his elbow. Almost all cuts and sprains happen during grappling. So you have to have great partners. You have to watch out. But to get that going, you do have to get that because some guys, the wrestling guy, he can stay on the ground all day long. And then he's not going to get tired at all. But then as soon as he stands up, he's going to start getting exhausted. So your training has to take place on the ground, on the feet. Your conditioning has to as well. Like we'll do burpees, and then they have to get up and strike. Then they get on their back, and then they have to escape, and then stand up immediately and just start going as fast as they can on the bag. Because then I want them to simulate punching as hard as they can without hurting their partner. So when I go all out on the punching, it's on the bag. When I go out all out on the drilling, it's standing up. Then we'll do takedown. We'll teach you takedown drills. Takedown, takedown, takedown. You know, just they have to be comfortable in every position. And as a coach, you have to drill that. And for a guy like Alex has takedown defense that looks like Chuck Liddell's already. He's already a takedown defense expert. You know, it's going to be really, really hard to take him down. And once he gets to the bottom, I saw him submit like multiple sparring partners with triangles, arm bars, etc. So this guy is going to make a serious wave in MMA. It's going to be crazy. Wow. But to answer your question, yeah, you have to practice conditioning and skills from every position because it's scary to be on the bottom. It's scary. It's scary as hell, especially being mounted. It's scary. And you have to learn how to relax and protect yourself in that position and not just learn the defense or the escapes because you have to protect yourself first. How many guys have you seen on the bottom just get knocked out with a vicious elbow? And that if that happens on the street, there's no referee stopping it. He's going to elbow you 20 more times. And now next thing you know, you're waking up 6 months later in a nursing home with a tracheostomy. And you've been in a coma. And please, I'm going to keep this G-rated. But please, all you guys out there, I don't care how cool you are and how debonair you think you are. If you're in a coma because you got the shit kicked out of you in a fight, your wife's not going to wait for you. She's not going to come visit you and turn you and hang out with you in the nursing home. She'll probably do that just for appearances for like the first week. But after that, she's going to be with your neighbor. So I'm just saying it's a terrible thing to think. And I want to think differently, but the same thing happens for you. If you want to be that tough guy and some guy touched your wife or said something to your wife. So instead of just like, keeping it, you know, like calm, you go in there and beat the heck out of him. Next thing you know, you're in prison. Guess what? She's going to end up with that guy while you're in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes absolutely no sense.
Yes, sir. Anyways, self-restraint and self-control. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. The one picture I've always had in my mind is this. looking through the bars. So it's definitely a wake up call.
It is a wake up call.
So, you know, when you were talking about the training, so it seems that we have to practice adapting. I mean, that, you know, because there's so many different aspects to martial arts, the striking, the kicking, the grappling, the exchanges, and just all the techniques, and people get caught up in those individualizations. Like, okay, we're punching now, and we're kicking now, and we're clinching now, and we're going to the ground now.
They even make it different days. They even like, this day, that's that. And they go to different gyms for each thing. And they even go to a different gym for their conditioning. And yeah, you're right.
Okay. Right. And so that kind of, you know, it's compartmentalizing what, you know, I mean, if I look at martial arts, it's the great adaptation. It's the great adaption. You have to adapt to everything around you. And, you know, Bruce Lee said it, you got to be like water. And, you know, the whole point is to adapt, but practicing adapting, it seems to be a very difficult thing when we get focused and compartmentalized on, okay, today's we're just going to box and punch, which, you know, we got to sharpen that skill. But when we're talking about fighting, it's not just punching. It's not just kicking. It's how fluidly can I go through the punches, the kicks, the clinches, my breathing, calm myself down. And all of that into one molecule is why I love martial arts, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you do. And I think the word is seamless.
Yes.
You know, there's a fine line between being seamless, which we want to do, and the finished product has to come out seamless. But there are seams. There are some days where, like yesterday. Yesterday, I just had the guys do 1,500 punches on the bag, and then 150 kicks on the bag because I want to build up the volume. Because then it becomes in their muscle memory. I got a lot of grapplers that turn to striking, but then when the fight starts, it's not in their muscle memory yet. So they're striking, which looked like this in training, is now like this.
Yeah.
So, and the same holds true for my strikers. I want them to do takedown. So we drill the takedown. Sometimes 10 minutes, it's just so monotonous. And people always say, like, when you're training, you know, you want to disguise the repetition. There's no, you can't disguise repetition. You just have to embrace repetition and realize, I mean, baseball, they're throwing the ball back and forth, back and forth. How do you disguise that? In basketball, they have to throw three free throws over and over and over. You don't disguise that.
Yeah.
The same, but for some reason in martial arts, the instructors say, well, you got to disguise repetition and this and this and this. So it's more fun for the guys, so we don't lose the students. I want this kind of students that realize repetition is the only way you're going to get better. You know, over and drill it. We do it like our stand-up guys. We drill the takedowns over and over and over and over. Then we drill takedown defense over, sprawl. Then we off the bottom, drill, get off the bottom, you know. So you have to drill these things. And then there's a seam between them, but then the finished product is seamless. And that's a skill right there as an instructor to do. And some of my fighters, they have no preference. Like I have a guy now that's 7-1 as a pro. He's been with me since he was 4 years old. He's 24 now. And so he has no seams. He'll take it to the ground, boom. He's submission, boom. He'll knock you out with a left hook, boom. He'll wrestle you, he'll jiu-jitsu you, or he'll strike you. And his conditioning is over the top. So he has no seams. But in training, as instructors, sometimes we want volume in certain places so there becomes seams. And so it's a fine line, and it's a tricky one. And like I said, when I hear disguised repetition, like in the Super Show, you know, half the seminars are like, how to keep your students, you got to disguise repetition.
Yeah.
I can't disguise left hook over and over and over, you know. It's just, to me, they have to embrace the repetition, and they have to love the fact that they know they're getting better at it.
I totally agree.
It's more old school, but, you know, that's just the way I think guys like us are.
No, I 100% agree with you. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the man that does one technique 10,000 times is the one to be feared, right? Instead of the guy that's doing all these other things. And I think oftentimes people think that if, as you advance in martial arts, as you advance in your level, that you're doing something new and something secret. You've got some other combinations that you're doing. But I think people fail to see. It's just, you've just been hacking away at that same thing so many times that it's so efficient. Your timing is so much better. You don't wasting any energy and it becomes effortless. And now it's installed in your operating system where you don't even have to think about it. That you're not actively doing it. It just happens by itself. And I think that's something that I don't know if you've experienced that or not, but I think that's something definitely that we could see more of, where that idea of that kind of method of training, because that's what gets to greatness. So if you see anybody that's an amazing martial artist or whatever level they've gotten to, they got to it because of those repetitions over and over and over and over and over again, but they knew what it was leading them towards.
Yeah, it's hard to disguise it. You know, I mean, I could see that with peewees and some of the younger kids. You know, you gotta play a game, and we do a, you know, we just, you know, well, like we'll do sumo or something with them, and you know, but we're still gonna hit the bag, and then we'll hit the pad. So I guess we're disguising something. It's a game, and some of my guys, they prefer, you know, one thing, you know, and they're gonna focus on that. Like, you know, like Chuck, he was a, you know, high level wrestler, high level jiu-jitsu guy, but he likes standing and brawling. You know, Glover, on the other hand, he likes taking people down, but he can knock people out too. I mean, ask Ryan Bader about that. Yeah. So, I mean, he can knock people out, but he also prefers the takedown. So for you to train people, you have to realize that. You can't put them into all your cookie cutter, you know, type training and think everybody's this or that or this. Some people are gonna like that better, and you can't make them not. So they have to learn all the skills because they want to be a martial artist, not a partial artist. But some people, like I said, Dan Anderson, give him that right hand. I bet you know, 99% of his everything is with that H-bomb. But he practiced. I'm sure he spent a lot of time defending the takedown, taking down people, etc. Yes. And you have to do that as martial arts instructors. You just have to now. It's like, this is 2020 now, and we have to accept the fact that fights are going to go to the ground. Fights are going to, you know, stay standing for you guys that want it to go to the ground. You know, conditioning is as important as any other technique or genre in martial arts. Without the conditioning, nothing else will work. So that's just as important as striking, just as important as wrestling, just as important as jiu-jitsu is your physical conditioning. And if you don't have it, you're a partial artist.
Sure. Yes, sir. Definitely. So, you know, if we go deeper into what you just mentioned there, if you go back to the first UFC, you know, it was singular, okay, grappler here, jiu-jitsu guy over here, boxer over here, kickboxer over here. So there were masters of one, right? One art, one range, one style. Then as we started to get deeper into it, then you have the next generation of people coming in, like, hey, you know what? You got to be able to box, you got to be able to kick, you got to be able to clinch, you got to be able to go to the ground. So now you're like, okay, we have these four compartments, right? The punching, the kicking, the clinching, and the ground. And of course, now the conditioning is added too, because in the beginning, maybe it wasn't as stressed. But now in 2020, where we are, would it be safe to say that, you know, there's that old saying that says, how does it go? It goes, jack of all trades, master of none. But right now in 2020, everybody's a jack of all trades because we have to know all those ranges. But you become a master of one, because from what I hear, what you're saying is, like, you see Chuck, he's got the takedown defense, he's got the jiu-jitsu, he's got that, but he's master of that right hand. Glover's guy can knock you out and do all that, but he's master of taking you down. And is that where you see it headed?
No, to be honest, like, because that's their preference. Mm-hmm. They're just as good at everything else. So they're not really mastering only that. I think that's their preference. But I'll give you one of my students. I have two students right now. They're both their names Isaiah, so it's an easy one for me to think of. They've been with me since they were 6 and 4, respectively. Now they're both in their 20s, but they have no master. They've mastered everything. Both of them would just as well go to the ground, just as well be on the grappling, just as well be in a clinch, or just as well be striking, and their conditioning is over the top. They don't have a master of any. They're they're just good at everything. Okay, so they're master level at everything. They're black belts and they're master level at anything. But when you say master of one, I'm thinking more of a preference than a skill level. You know what I mean? So like Chuck was just as skilled.
Yes.
And his takedowns as he was with his right hand.
I understand.
But he preferred to just keep it standing. Yes. So I understand that, you know, that's a, you know, master of but master of none? Skill.
Jack of all trades.
Jack of all trades, master of none. But I think today they're jack of all trades, but they're master of all.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's some that prefer, I'd rather keep it standing. Damian Maia wants to take it to the ground, right? Chuck Liddell likes to keep it standing. Glover Teixeira wants a takedown and some pounding, you know? So I think they're masters of all now. I think they've, and I think the Gracies more than anyone else in the world have made this a reality in martial arts. They've exposed the bad parts of certain martial arts, and then they've brought out the greatness in martial arts, and they've created how great martial arts is as a whole. And I think I think they're the first ones to do it. Bruce Lee was on his way to doing that. If you read Tao of Jeet Kune Do, he was on his way. Tommy Lee in Hawaii did an MMA type thing. I was 16 years old and I lied about my age and I entered it. And it was the two guys, they put me and my opponent in a dressing room and they asked us what the rules were. Like if you wanted to punch, you had to put on gloves. If you wanted to elbow, you had to put an elbow pad on. And that you decided the rules ahead of time, what you wanted to do. So it was kind of interesting. And then you just came out and it was kind of wrestling against this. And it was kind of like that, but it was in the 70s. So it was kind of interesting. Benny the Jet fought in that.
Awesome.
So did Jeff Smith.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was, so that came out back in the old days. But so I think that's way better to say. It's like, you're master of all, but some people have a preference.
I understand.
You know what I mean? So what would your, like if somebody, you're walking your, do you have a wife?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So you walk in your beautiful wife. I'm sure she's beautiful. You walk in your beautiful wife to the parking lot. You're in the parking lot at Walmart. It's 9 o'clock at night. You just got some ice cream. So you go home and have a party. And some guy, you don't know why, it doesn't matter why, he shoves you up against the car, right? Up against your car, and he's coming at you to knock you unconscious. Your wife's standing there on the side. She's looking at what you're going to do, right? And you want to protect her because if he beats the shit out of you and you're unconscious, you know he's going to do bad things to her. Yes. So you have to defend her right now. What would be your first go-to technique? He's coming at you. Your back's to the car. Bing, what are you going to do?
I would hit him before he gets into range.
Okay. So with what?
With a finger jab right in the eye.
That's your go-to. Is that your go-to?
You know, to be honest, I prefer. I know it's the fastest tool. It's the one I practice the best to keep the range. Yeah. And then I kick the knee. But to be honest, I would have to hit him with where he's open as fast as possible without thinking about
it. So you would go for a target of opportunity, not a target of preference.
Yes.
Some people have both.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I would left hook no matter what. Every single time the left hook is going to come out first, no matter what. And I don't care if people know it. And then I guarantee if you do that to Glover, he's going to right there. As soon as his back gets to the car, he's going to rush you with a double leg and your head will bounce off the concrete and you will be in a coma.
Yes.
But everybody has their favorite. Chuck would be a straight right, guaranteed.
Yeah.
So everybody has their what's that Walmart parking lot technique that's going to come out, you know?
Yeah.
Because and they have to know that over and over, because it will happen. I just saw a video of a bunch of protesters coming into a restaurant, and they were coming in the back door. People had already come in the front door. So you can't go out the back door anymore. Now you're trapped in this freaking restaurant, and you got a bunch of violent protesters, and like what are you going to do? And I played that in my head so many times, because the entrance and the exit were both already taken, and you'd have to go through the people, which is a bad thing to do. I even called Tim Kennedy, who is probably the best person in the world to deal with these kind of scenarios because of his background. And his I didn't like his answer, because he's so far above all of us people that his answer is, this is his answer. It's like, so it's too like Bruce Lee-ish. Like, his answer was, before he goes anywhere now, right, he checks these apps that he has, and he knows where like these groups are going to be before he goes anywhere, so he avoids them. So his avoidance is his best. And people that say, you know, situational awareness, I agree with that 100%. But like, if you're in a concert, you have no such thing, because the guy's right behind you, he's this close to you.
Yeah.
Right? Some guy you don't know, you're getting out of your car in a Walmart parking lot, and some guy rushes towards you. You're situationally aware, then all of a sudden he comes out of a blind spot. So it's not always an option to get away from a conflict. You can't always try to de-escalate someone when they're swinging on you already. You go, hey, whoa, hey, seems like you're having a bad day. It's too late for that sometimes. And to me, the self-defense guys, that's a Band-Aid. You can, deter, you know, talk them down, you know, de-escalate. That's a Band-Aid. I love Band-Aids because they stop infections. Band-Aids are great. But sometimes you're in a car accident, your arm gets ripped off. Band-Aid's not going to help. You need a trauma surgeon, you know. And that's the kind of self-defense I like to think of. When it's a trauma surgeon, not a Band-Aid, not like, okay, I'm going to be aware of my surroundings. That's great. I love that. De-escalate. I love that. Avoid every fight you can. But sometimes that guy's going to come out of nowhere, shove you. It doesn't matter why he's having a bad day. You just want to make sure you go home with your beautiful wife so you can eat your Häagen-Dazs ice cream and have a little bit of bourbon. That's all you want in life. At the end of the day, that's all there is, right?
Words to live by, man. That's for sure. You know, I think one thing that's very important you said there is that it's always the punch that you didn't see coming. It's the attack that you didn't see coming. It's the surprise, right? Because, you know, if we go back to, you see a guy approaching you, if you have situational awareness, you have room, you have time, you can enact other things. But then there's going to be other times where you're looking one way and somebody clocks you from the other side and you didn't see it, right? You're distracted one way, and that's violence, right? Somebody stabs you from behind, you don't see it. That's violence. And I think that's what you're alluding to, is that when you're in that situation where if you don't have space and you don't have time and you don't have awareness, because you're surprised. I mean, this is the surprise element, that attack, that like in the concert, or, you know, you're at a party, or you're normally, it always happens when you're in a place where there's a shit, where there's a whole bunch of people all around you, and maybe some of your senses are a little bit lower, but I definitely agree with you. I think being in the brawl and then having to calm down and make a decision and then pull off whatever your strategy and tactic is going to be just as important as trying to avoid it if you had space.
Yeah, and I think it's great to be situationally aware and stuff, but you don't have, as humans, sometimes we're just walking down the street texting. I mean, right. we're not, you know, all the time, and that's when the stuff, to me, that's when my stuff comes out, and people say, well, you know, you block the first strike and then you do this and that. if we could block the first strike, nobody would get hit in the UFC because they block the strike. Unfortunately, you can't. Like when you're someone's doing a chokehold, we're doing chokehold defense this week. That's on our curriculum. So we're defending the choke, and everybody's this, this, and this. It's not this, this, and this. It's this, try your best, this, try your best, and hope for the best because it doesn't always work. If it always worked, two guys get choked out this week in the UFC, and I guarantee you they probably spent 15 years of their life defending chokes.
Yes.
Because they're jiu-jitsu guys. They're still getting choked because, you know, our strikers, they're still getting hit. You cannot block every strike. You cannot defend every choke. You have the harder you train, the more lucky you become.
Right.
The harder you train, it raises your odds to get out of that. So it's a game of luck back and forth, but the harder you train, the more luck you will have. So we want to try to go in there with the most luck we have, because that one punch that gets through that knocks you unconscious, boom, you know what I mean? You're waking up 6 months later, you know, with a tracheostomy and a feeding tube. And that's the way it's going to be. So you got to pray. You got to train for the worst scenario and hope for the best. And that's the way we train. You got to train scared so you can be more confident. But when you're training, you have to realize this guy, he might be the worst fighter in the world. But when 200-pound guy, even if he's just swinging like this, if that one punch lands on the chin, you are dead. You know, I mean, you're dead. You're unconscious. If you're unconscious and there's no referee and he's like some guy in a Walmart parking lot who's just out of his mind crazy, or you cut him off and you didn't know about it and he's that angry, you know, you're dead because he's going to soccer kick you into oblivion. So it's a scary world out there. But we have to prepare for the worst and pray for the best. So that's self-defense. And, you know, I wish I could block every strike, you know. But when this guy's swinging, you know, it's just the luck of the draw. Are you going to block it, or is it going to get through? That's why I always, always, always say to stack the odds in your favor, hit first.
Yeah.
There's no, I mean, I don't see any way around that. I teach my kids that in school too, because people that say, like, even I've had Gracie guys disagree with me. No, that's, then they're the bully. And I say, no, then they're the ones that's not in the hospital with a subdural hematoma, because they say, no, you do it the more gentle way, take the guy down. Really? You ever seen anybody take down on the concrete? Boom. You are much more likely to have brain damage, acute and chronic, or die from a head trauma from your head hitting the concrete than a fist hitting your face.
Yes, sir.
So I teach my kids to always hit first. Never start the fight. Never fight over words. Never fight over a threat. Never fight over a challenge. But don't anyone ever take your lunch money. And so I think striking first is the best way to stack the odds in your favor, because if they start swinging first, oh, I'm blocking, boom.
Yes.
Yeah. And so anyway.
I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree with you. You know,
A lot of people don't.
I do. And, you know, it's like when you had asked me that question earlier, I'm like, hey, he gets into range, he gets hit.
Yeah.
It's that simple. You know, I mean, and if I can't avoid it, then we're now in a different range of a fight. But if I'm taking, you know, there's an old boxing coach who used to say, the firstest with the mostest is the bestest, right? And of course, I think for the people listening, you know, one thing that's very important is that this is where you have to have the conscious awareness to be able to understand that, hey, this situation warrants me to hit first right now. Otherwise, it could be much more dangerous. And like it said, the thing is, you're not fighting out of ego. You're not fighting out of pride. You're not fighting because somebody said something to your wife, you know, for all those reasons, which are not reasons to fight. And you have to have that awareness that, hey, we're in this right now. This guy, and you have to read that guy's body language, how he's approaching you, and be able to see it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you got to go first, right? And, you know, we say jokingly, the art is of four circles, these two and then the ones down here. So whichever one comes first, hit that quick, hit it hard. And, But I think that also requires awareness and responsibility, like you said, as to the person doing it has to understand that, hey, then now is the time to go. But
people don't like to hear that. People don't like to hear that because it goes against their sensibilities. Most people have never been in a fight in their life. So there is, like I say, if you have a knife, you're fighting a knife guy, man, it's cruel to stab him first. So you got to get stabbed first. You're dead if you get stabbed first. If you have a gun, guy has a gun and you have a gun, do you wait till he shoots you first? You shoot him first? Are you the criminal? No, because if he shoots you first, you could die. People don't realize if you get hit, if you get punched, you can die. Yeah. You can die from that. That one punch can knock you backwards, your head hits the concrete, or that punch causes, you know, brain damage. You could die. So, yeah, never fight over words. I agree with that. Unless the word is, these are the only words you fight over. Somebody that's in range and says to you these words, I'm going to kill you or I'm going to punch you in the face right now. I'm going to take that at face value, and that's a threat right there. And that's, for you guys that don't know it, that's assault. That's a felony.
Yeah.
So he's just striking first. People don't want to hear it, and you know, oh, you're not being self-defense. Now you're the bully, and that's one of my things.
That's what interception's all about, right? I mean, if you think there's three times to hit somebody: before their action, during their action, or after the action. And after the action, I mean, you know, and we don't get to choose. So if we're lucky and we see it and we have the awareness to do it, I think that it's important. But for all the listeners listening, the caveat here is that you got to first and foremost be able to calm yourself down and make sure that you are not striking first out of your own emotional imbalance, that your own anger, your own thoughts, and your own fear, and that you're detached from the situation and that you can make that choice. And I think that's where the fine line goes, where you know, if you're battle tested or you've been in situations, your ability to choose is your weapon, right? And your awareness allows you to do that. And if it warrants hitting first, you got to go first. You got to intercept that person before they do it. I don't want to find out how good this guy is.
Yeah.
I don't want to find out how strong he is once he gets a hold of me. I don't want to find out how good his jiu-jitsu is and his boxing is. He steps into range, he's got to get hit.
Yeah, and I think that, I think there's a moral compass involved too. I'm 60 years old. I've never been arrested. I've never been in trouble. I've been in a lot of fights. I'm from a rough place. Been a lot of school fights in school. Even as an adult, I've been in, you know, a lot of fights, but I've never been arrested. I've never been in trouble. A moral compass. I think a moral person isn't going to attack anyone. And one thing I do is I back off. I say it really loud, back off. That's one of our things, is back the F off, but I'm not going to use that. If somebody's coming towards you and you say back off, you have to think hard. If I'm walking towards somebody and they told me to back off, I'm backing off.
Yes.
I don't care who it is, unless they just hurt one of my family members or they're, you know, I don't know, something, they're doing something hard, you know, harmful to me. If it's a person and we're arguing about something and they say back off, I'm backing off. Anyone that's not a criminal is going to back off. Anyone that keeps coming is a criminal, and you need to deal with them as one. They're violent. By walking forward, they're assaulting me, and they're a criminal as far as I'm concerned. I told them to back off. You know, if somebody gets this close to my face and yelling at you, who does that? Who raised that person? What kind of person does that? A violent person that's about to hit you. And you have to realize that, because I bet you wouldn't, in a million years, I would never get this close. I disagree with people's politics all the time. I disagree with people's driving all the time. I disagree with people's manners all the time. I'm 60 years old. I've never gotten this close to anyone's face and yelled at them. I would never do that. I might stand away and call them a name and walk away, but I would never assault anyone and come towards them in an aggressive manner. And if somebody's going to do that to you, you have to realize they have ill intentions and they have criminal behavior and their moral compass is askew. And you need to deal with that immediately or they're going to deal with you. Because if you don't have a plan for them, believe me, they'll have a plan for you. And it's usually waking up in a nursing home.
Yeah. No, I think that's very important. And for the listeners listening, I think that's the key is that if the opportunity is there, you have to use your words. You know, you get your hands up, say stop. And you say stop. And you project your voice and you've told this person what to do. They make the next choice to step forward. So, and everybody around you has also had a chance to see you with your hands up telling the person to stop. And now they're
with their videos. With their videos.
You, I told you to stop and you
hands open
forward. And so now you have chosen to get hit.
But
I gave you an option, right? And like you said, there's no moral compass. And why does somebody get that close to you? They're getting that close
to you. Who does that?
Something bad is about to happen. You know, you don't let any animal get that close to you.
Never. I wouldn't even let a raccoon get that close to me because they would kick my ass.
Definitely not a raccoon.
It's never. And, you know, I get that all the time, but they're hitting first and yada, yada, yada. It's just people that have never been in a fight realize that. But who does that? It's like, who would do that? Get this close to you. It's a violent person. Who would walk to you? Your hands have to be open, guys. Don't go like this with closed fists and say, back off. Because now if there's a video camera with no sound, it looks like you just started that fight. So anything that happens after that, it's on you. So this is the way you should go about it. And it's, you know, you have to realize this is my role. This is my perimeter right here. My front hand, back away. If they come into it, they're going to walk into some strikes and they're going to start hard and fast. If they're my face, it's going to be a short hook because, you know, sometimes somebody will just get in your face wherever. But that person, who raised the person? It just drives me nuts when I watch the videos, you see them all the time, self-defense videos, and they're arguing back and forth, and the one guy throws the punch, and he knocks the other guy out, and you're thinking, why would the guy stay there for that long? I'm not saying he deserved to get hit. But he definitely asked for it.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's very important because the other thing you had mentioned there, your hands have got to be open and they got to be up because you're giving it. And that's another thing, those of you watching the video, if you know Coach, he wasn't standing square, he bladed. And so when you blade, you're giving that space and distance controls the timing. So if he's in too close, now we don't know what's going to happen. Things get muffled up. And if you close your fists, everybody outside just saw you close your fist, and that's the last.
And so did he. That's one thing where people say, if somebody gets that close to you, right, and you can't back up, I would back up first. But when I do this, I'm assuming you can't back up.
Yeah.
But people say, well, why don't you just shove them out of the way? I'll tell you why I would hit them first and not shove them. Because now they've offended me. They're offensive to me. They're about to hurt me. They're assaulting me. So I want to get the edge. I don't want an even fight. In the cage, I want it to be even. It's sportsmanship. It's sport and it's Bushido. But when it's this close, I don't want it to be close. So once I shove him, now his hands come up and my hands come up. Now we're 50-50. Yeah. I don't want 50-50. I want to get the edge. So I want to hit him first. And whether that stuns him a little or throws him off balance or knocks him out, I want to get the first strike in. So if I shove him, now we're both in fighting range, and it's a fight. And it's a 50-50 fight. I might win, but I just gave him the option, right, to win, to beat me. So I just told him I want to fight. I laid my hands on him. If I'm going to lay my hands on him, I want to try to knock him out, not just create distance with a push.
I agree. You know, I think that's the thing is that now you've said to everybody in the whole world that we're fighting and they saw you shove him back. And that's everything kind of starts to change. And now the whole gambit of things opens up. And if you look at the fight itself, it's that element of surprise where if you can cause that first moment of pain, you steal that beaten time and now you're ahead of it. I mean, because you know, if we'd be honest, if you've been in fights before, if you've been unfortunate enough to be in situations where there's never one-on-one, it's never going to be one-on-one. It's so rare that then you got to think about, okay, we're in a street altercation. How do I put this? The complexity of what could go on is crazy, because a weapon could come out, an edge weapon, a blunt weapon come out. The car is a weapon, your head smashing into it. The homies are there. Nobody goes outside. Nobody goes anywhere by themselves. So it's not like in the movies. And then when you have mass attackers, they don't all circle you and then come at you one at a time. So that escaping to gain safety, I think is something very important. And that's in your control. But once again, I can't stress enough that if you do not have the self-awareness and the empathetic awareness of the other person, because we talk about situational awareness, but I think we have to also, we forget that the awareness of the individual making the situation, what's going on with you right there? Can you calm yourself down right now? Your heart starts to pound. Can you take a deep breath? Can you slow that down? And have you trained that as part of your training? And then the ability to watch, observe, and read the guy in front of you. Because this guy in front of you, like, what's going on with him? Can you feel what's happening? And I think that's something that's the intangible part that oftentimes is missing, and people go straight to techniques or they go to different strategies where the awareness is the true weapon.
Yeah, I see that. I see that both ways. And when people say, and another thing I like to think about is each situation. And what if we lived in a country or a world where it was self-defense, there was no self-defense, it was illegal. So sometimes I try to think of that, because self-defense, if you lose the case in court, it's going to get ugly, especially if you hurt the guy or even killed him. I had a student that killed his attacker, and he didn't go to court. I mean, the cops came, took him to the station, asked him a few questions, and asked a couple of witnesses a few questions, and they determined it right there in the precinct. They determined it, oh, it was self-defense. And they just let him go. He never went to court, never heard another word about it. He read about it in the paper, but he was self-defense. That's the best case scenario. Of if you had to kill someone, that's not the best case. But the fact that he didn't even go to court for it. But you have to realize you are going to go to court. And you're going to go to court for criminal charges, and definitely for civil charges of the guy's family or whatever. But if you take that one step further, what if you're not going to go to court? What if it's just illegal? What if self-defense were completely illegal? So even if they came at you with a weapon and you defended yourself and hurt them, you're going to jail for assault. You hurt them or kill them, you're going to jail for murder. So I think of that as self-defense, because it makes me feel even better that chances are I'm never going to attack anyone, so it's going to be self-defense, and I'll at least have the ability to fight for my freedom if I defend myself. But then when you put yourself in that worst-case scenario, that we live in a land, which might happen with all the shit going on nowadays, we don't know what's going to happen. What if it is 100% illegal to defend yourself? And I say, I still would, because I would rather end up in prison than in the morgue, right? No matter what my chances of getting away scot-free with self-defense or not, because people say, well, you hit first, you might do this. I would rather end up in court, in jail. And let me just say something. If I end up in jail, I pray for a good-looking cellmate that knows how to give massages and pedicures. But anyway, that's beside the point. I would rather end up in jail or even state prison than dead or in a nursing home in a coma. So no matter how the odds are stacked against me legally, I am still going to defend my life, my limb, and my family without even thinking of the repercussions. I will do things like keep my hand open and yell really loudly, I don't want to fight, I don't want to fight. That's all for the camera. That's all because I don't want to fight. I'd rather go home, but I want that to help me if it does go to court. But even if it was completely illegal, I'm still going to fight. I'm still going to defend myself. I would rather go to jail, prison than the morgue or the nursing home.
Hey man, I agree with you, man. I think that's the thing, and it's a fine line, and it comes down to each person and the choice they're going to make. So, and to recap, if you think about it, to the listeners, there's three fights. There's the fight before the fight, what's going on, right? Then people talk about that, the situational awareness, what's going on with you, what's going on. Do you know what's going on around you? Then there's the actual fight, the engagement, and then as Coach just mentioned, there's the fight afterwards. So there's that the fight in court. And so it's three things, and people will always have their opinions which way to go. But I think that your safety and your life is more important than anything else in the world.
What would you do with an extra 7 hours in your week? Sleep an extra hour each day? Get in an extra hour of practice each day? Spend more time with your family? Or maybe take a lunch break? Enter Wattify, the all-in-one martial arts software that has everything you need to run a stronger business. It's an all-in-one system. Martial arts school owners say Wattify has saved them at least 7 hours per week. Instead of spending hours manually scanning waivers, use Wattify's digital waivers. Instead of having to manually bill your clients and pay your employees each month, Wattify bills clients and pays out employees automatically. Did I mention that clients can easily sign into and up for classes via the client mobile app? Trusted by over 5,000 business owners around the world, Wattify helps overwhelmed martial arts school owners reclaim their time and be more confident in their success. Go to wattify.com/blackbelt to claim 50% off your first 2 months today. That's wodify.com/blackbelt.
So to segue from there, what I definitely want to talk to you about is that, you're one of the very few people out there that has a traditional background in Hawaiian Kenpo. You boxed Golden Gloves, and now you train MMA fighters. And even in your gym, you guys wear gis, and you have the code. And, you mentioned moral compass. Anybody who talks about the words moral compass knows and instills these things inside of people. And I really want to start talking about that. And, what is your unique perspective on it? Because, in the martial art world today, most of the time you see either sport happening over here, or over here you see, super traditional. And then over here you have like street fighting, reality-based, or, combatives are the terms that are thrown out there. But you're one of the very few people that successfully runs and operates a business where you have all three incorporated. And I personally think that's something that attributes to your success.
Oh, thanks. I guess to me, they just always combine with each other. I love traditional martial arts. I love where I trained, how I trained. I remember so well knowing I was going to get bullied at school when I hit intermediate school, what they call it, middle school now, junior high school. I knew things were going to get tough for me there, being, the blonde white kid in Hawaii. I went into a martial arts school and I fell in love with everything about it, from the gis to the belt system, to the bowing, to the prayer, to the code of conduct, and then I just happened to be with the toughest guy around, in and out of prison, just a rough, tough criminal guy, but he was rough and tough, and he somehow taught me, how to be tough and how to be traditional. But when we talk about the moral compass, I had a dad that was a World War II vet. He went to West Point. He was just the most moral guy I knew. And I had that moral compass. So no matter how much I hung with the guys and did this with the guys, I liked to do a lot of the stuff with the guys growing up, but I knew what I shouldn't do morally. I had a good moral compass because of my dad. So I had toughness because of my martial arts instructor. And then I had the moral compass because of my dad. And I kind of combined those together. So I don't train the guy the way that my instructor trained me. But I've been around a lot of other martial arts schools growing up, like Cecil Peoples. He was one of my, I don't know if you've ever heard of Cecil Peoples, but he had a very successful Kempo gym in LA, and he was under Bill Ryasaki, who was also Benny the Jet Yukiti's instructor, and Stuart Schumann his instructor. So Cecil came up, he was a big point fighter in his day, and he refereed and judged too as well. So I've seen a lot of other martial arts schools, Bill Parent, et cetera, where I could, you know, say, well, I want to be more like that and more of a family feel, like Chuck Cordova. You know Chuck Cordova and Carol Cordova. They're out of Denver, Littleton, Colorado, and they have a really successful school. I'm affiliated with them as well. And just the traditionality and the family feel, I love it all. But I also want my guys to be tough. And sometimes I get missed, you know, people think, oh, he's just a tough guy. You don't want to go there. You'll get the shit kicked out of you. They just beat the hell out of each other. No, we don't. Nobody beats up anyone. We train how to be tough because being tough, you don't ever hear Joe Rogan say, wow, that guy's tough. That's terrible.
Right.
There's no downside to being too tough. You don't want to be a tough guy and be a bully, but being tough is only good. Tough guys are much more functional and they're much more practical and they serve much more of a purpose in life than weak guys. So being tough is something we teach at our gym and we drill that in our drill gym, but we also want you to be humble. We push Bushido. We want you to be courteous, generous, kind. I don't care about being nice, but you do have to be kind. So I believe in all these tenets that are taught in traditional martial arts, but I also know firsthand that you got to be tough because when somebody jumps you, you need to respond with a tough persona or you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. Okay. Now, when it comes to the sport, for some reason, I know that people come to me mainly because of Chuck and Glover and stuff. So they come to me, I want to fight in MMA. And even though that's the least favorite of my things to do, and that's lowest on my priority list, it's high when I train the guys. And I take it very seriously that they have a goal and I want to help them because for some reason, God put me here to do that. And even though it's not my favorite thing to do, I respect the people that are doing it, and I will try my best to get them as high as I can on the MMA ladder. So that's one of my things. Self-defense, stay safe in the street, defend your family, don't be bullied so you have more confidence as a kid. Very important, right? Traditional martial arts, family feel. We're one big ohana, which means family in Hawaiian, and we stick together and we act like a family. Very important to me. And then for the MMA guys, if you want to fight and you're in my town or not in my town, like Glover, and you want me to help you get to the top, I'll do that too, because for whatever reason, and Tony Robbins told me this, or else I wouldn't be doing it anymore. You're put here, God put you here for that. So you owe it to the people that come to you to go up the ladder in MMA. You owe it to them. Whether you want to do it or not, that doesn't really matter right now. Tony Robbins told me that. So how do you say no to that, right? So those are my three, kind of like you got mind, body, spirit. Things come in threes like that, right? And this happens to be, you know, traditional martial arts, hardcore street defense and bully prevention, and sport MMA.
So, you know, you read my mind because I was going to ask you about Tony Robbins. And I think one of the things is martial arts instructors, we are in the business of courage, confidence, and clarity. I mean, that's what we're given to the students, right? It's the punches and the kicks and the grappling and the trapping and the wrestling and jiu-jitsu and all the other stuff that we do is a means to an end. How did you, but one of the most important things that martial arts gives us, or it has for me at least, is a vehicle. It's been a vehicle of self-discovery where I could find, it allowed me to find out who I really am and to honestly express myself, as opposed to trying to be a mold of something I should be, or something somebody told me I should be, or do things somebody told me. And I could think for myself and be like, well, this is who I really am. And this is what I'm going to express to the world. How did you come about that for yourself to be able to have that honest self-expression that, hey, I'm put here by God to be a martial arts instructor and influence the lives. And you know, you've influenced the lives of many people beyond your town because of the outreach that you've had with the fighters that you've trained.
Yeah. I've never gotten that deep into it, to be honest. It's like, I always think the moral compass, because of my dad, the toughness I needed right then and there, and it came at me. I walked, God put me, you know, I looked in the yellow pages, and for some reason this one gym popped out at me, and I caught the bus at like 9 years old, and I just knew the second I walked in that 500 square feet, there was like two makiwaras and a heavy bag. That was it. And I walked in, I just felt, and I can remember it like it was yesterday, I felt, this is my home. I'm never going to leave this place. 500 square feet, it was tiny. My office is like that. Oh, you can't see my office because I got the backdrop. But my bedroom is bigger than that now. You know, it's like, but I knew that's what I was going to be for the rest of my life. And my instructor, I knew he had his flaws and his, you know, criminality and his, you know, just the way we trained was a little too rough. But I just knew this was my life. Nowhere else would I rather be than that place. So if it wasn't for me walking in that place, you know, growing up the way I grew up, where I grew up, you know, the way I looked, I would probably, if it wasn't for martial arts, I would probably be wearing a floral dress right now, sipping coffee with one of my friends, and I would be a completely different person. The kind of person I look at right now, and I just think, So that it molded me into something that's so important to me. I want everybody to realize that. And I think the biggest thing that it gave me, without, you know, getting too in depth with it, is confidence. And the confidence saved me. It saved me the way I looked, the way I acted. When I say the way I looked, not look, but the way I looked at people, the way I acted around people. I never wanted to bully anyone, but nobody, I wouldn't let anyone bully me. I was a smart ass to everyone. I think I'm very kind, but I'm not really known as a nice guy, and that's fine. But then, you know, I always wanted to just be that guy. And I want other people to realize that. Like, I want all the kids out there. I don't want any kids to get bullied. It's such a good feeling to walk at school and just look at them and say, what's up, man, what's up? And nobody's going to look at you to try to bully you. And that feeling that you know, I had in the beginning of school when I was younger, growing up where I grew up, you know, I was bullied. And I kind of walked around I had knots in my stomach all the time because I was scared. But once I started training in martial arts, I walked around like, hey, what's up, man, how you doing? You know, I get up the biggest, toughest football player. I go, what's up, man? How you doing, bro? All right, good. Good to see you. I was never not confident from that day. I'd say from like 12 years old to right now, I could never walk anywhere and be scared of anyone. And that feeling is so good. It's such a good feeling. You know, it is a martial artist. It's just such a good feeling to walk anywhere and just like, hey, what's up? You know, I want everybody to have that feeling. And then when it comes to the MMA, so that's the martial arts and the self-defense. Then when it comes to MMA, I don't really care that much. But I love them as athletes. And I know I was there. So I realize, and if they come to me, I will get them as far as I can in that sport. But while they're doing it, they're my students. And I'm going to teach them no bullying. Like, if one of the first things I teach my fight team, you get in a fight that you started, you're off the team immediately. You cheat on your significant other, whether it's your wife or your girlfriend, you're off the team immediately. Okay? You smart off to your opponent in the ring, in the cage, you act with disrespect to your, you're off the team, you know? And they know that. So you'll never see one of my fighters acting like that or doing that kind of shit because they're off the team immediately. And they're in my class too. Like if everybody on my team is a belt and they're in the traditional part of my gym too. Chuck was, Glover is, Cor McGee is, Ramsey is. They're all part of my belt system, Hawaiian Kempo belt system, as well as on my team. And they have to carry themselves a certain way or they're off both.
I like that. I like that a lot. You know, and I think that shows in the results, not only in the ring, but outside the ring, you know, in the character.
Oh, you never see. You'll never see one of my guys throwing a dolly through a fucking bus. You'll never see that. You'll never see my guy throwing shit as a, you'll never see that. My guys goof around with their opponent. They might have fun, but respect is very important. And they know to respect your opponent, give him the utmost respect. If you knock him out, you don't go celebrating. You sit down with respect until he gets up. Okay. But in the street, if someone jumps you in the street, there's no respect at all. This person is to be treated like the worst kind of piece of shit animal out there. You have to defend your life with whatever it takes. He gets no respect. Okay. Your opponent in a sport fight gets the utmost respect. Now for kids, schoolyard dominance, it's somewhere in between. You're not hating them and you want to kill them, you know, but you don't treat them with the utmost respect. You just have more confidence. So that's why teaching kids self-defense and adult self-defense is very different. And then teaching adult self-defense, adults MMA, there's a lot of differences there too. But at the end of the day, Bushido says it all.
The code of conduct. You know, I think that's, if you don't have a code of conduct, my sifu would say, if you don't have a code of conduct, then when you're tested, you're going to like float around in the wind. You don't have something to anchor you down. You know, he would say, kindness is your king. Compassion is your queen. Embrace pain as your brother and he'll walk with you forever. And, you know, and it changed my life, right? Because then we have this, because the other war that oftentimes people don't talk about is the one that's going on between the ears, right? The one inside here going on 24/7, 365. And martial arts gives you that ability to see things clearly for what they are so that we can make changes in our patterns and our behaviors outside of the ring, outside of the dojo, because how many fights do people really get in? We prepare for the worst, but there's a war going on in our head all the time about think about the limiting things, the things we engage in, the things we react to. And you know, when you look at all the great warriors from the past, the great books that have been written, and even into the modern times, people that really discovered the truth about themselves and can accept it, face it, make themselves comfortable. I think it's a priceless experience, you know, and we get caught up, especially in today's day and age, with so much chaos outside. And I think, and you tell me what you think. I think people think that between chaos and peace, that there's, you know, my sifu explained to me when I would ask him, you know, what's the difference between chaos and peace? And he said, there is no difference because chaos is always happening. Peace is a choice inside of chaos. You choose peace when chaos is happening. It means like, and then he said, oh, I don't understand what you're saying. He's like, all right, if I give you a jab, you roll with it. You're choosing peace. So because we can't expect chaos, we can't expect peace to be the absence of chaos, just like we can't expect courage in the absence of fear. And I think once you start to understand that and accept it, that's that real warrior's way that we're really blessed to experience.
See, you're lucky. You had like a Miyagi type sifu. My instructor, who spent over 25 years of his life in prison, like his thing would be like, you know, you just punch him in the fucking face and I would be like, he would be like, you know, just always the violent way, just always a violent way. And he, you know, I mean, he was in prison once for manslaughter. I mean, it's like somebody beeps at you and the light turns green before you go. Yeah. I mean, his thing was you go back and you punch him in the face. It's like, so learning that and then knowing, you know, because I was growing, you know, I brought up on my dad and I was like, knowing that that was wrong, but most of his students ended up, you know, like kind of hooligan guys and fighters and, you know, getting in, you know, street fights and getting in trouble and selling drugs and stuff like that. So it was harder for me because I didn't have, my instructor made me tough. He made me tough. He did good by me. He did a great job doing that. I love him for that. I stayed with him. He came to Chuck's black belt test, flew from Hawaii, and he loved the pit. I mean, I started with his system, but then I created Hawaiian Kempo back in 1985. I started with Kaji Kempo with him. And then, he loved Hawaiian Kempo. He loved the pit. He came to, you know, a bunch of my black belt tests and until he passed away. But he was always that guy that you know, I've seen him beat the shit out of people. I've seen him enter turn, you know, when I entered tournaments when I was a kid and yelling at me to punch him in the face, just like the Bad Karate Kid guys is like, and I would, and I'd get disqualified, and he would hug me for that and think I did good. And I was like, something's wrong, you know, but he made me tough, you know, and I love him for that. And but I didn't get that, like, self, that martial arts Miyagi-san, you know, code of this. That came later, just realizing that being tough and being confident was so much better than not.
Yeah.
You know, and that changed me, like, in me, because my instructor didn't give me those words of wisdom that yours did. His was punch him in the face, kick his ass, you know. So I get that the hard way. I had to learn, and I was in the military, and that helped a lot with my discipline and stuff, being, you know, in the Army. So, you know, I got that part of that out of it, and I try to put that to my student base. And to be honest, like, people like, you know, Maya and Sentry and guys like, you know, Bill Clark and CMA and, you know, all that stuff, that's really helped me become a better martial arts instructor and just see, you know, because you're trying to do your own way and trying to be successful, but you're trying to be tough and try to be different and try to be individual, but you also want to, you know, pay the rent, you know. So those kind of things help me combine them, you know what I mean? Combine the, you want to make a living, and people say, well, you sell out your martial art. And it's like, really? Because if I don't train people, then nobody's going to get the benefits. So, you know, if like teaching online, I've had people say, ah, that's selling out. You know, you're going to give belts online. You're selling out. It's not good. Then all of a sudden this pandemic happened. And then every single one of those people that said, oh, you can't train people online, you can't give belts online, every single one of them went to Zoom and started doing their classes online.
Right.
So it is a way to do it. I believe 100% that you can train them online. You know, just like you can give a PhD online, you can, there's all kind of courses now that you can teach people. So I think and it's a good way to reach other people. I mean, I live in a small town of 15,000 people, you know?
Yeah.
I do have some affiliate gyms around the country, around the world, actually. But to me, you can reach so much more people, and, you know, your comes out the same way. I feel like you can teach the same lessons without being, you know, face to face.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, when you were talking about the teachers earlier, I've had three teachers in my life, and one of them was like your teacher too. So I understand, and I think sometimes what ends up happening is when you see the darkness, it's easier to see the light. And when I hear you speak, I hear somebody that cares. I hear somebody that cares. Like if I was to say, put the pit master and put one word on him, I'm like, that guy cares. He cares. Yeah, I mean, that's the vibe I got, man. I'm listening to him. I mean, he cares. He cares about his students. He cares about his fighters. He cares about himself. He cares about his family. He cares. And that's you know, that's the thing that it's like when we can get to the point when we realize that it's not about us and get over our own selfish limitations and our need for pride and ego and acting out of fear. And we realize that, oh man, dude, this is not about me. This is about the kids. This is about the families that come to me. This is about my community. This is me protecting everybody. You know, there's a creed that I learned by Robert L. Humphrey. Actually, one of my training partners taught it to me years ago, and I adopted it. And he said, and Robert L. Humphrey was a World War II veteran after, obviously, World War II. And he said, wherever I go, anyone in need has a friend. Wherever I am, everyone is a little bit safer. But when I come home, they're happy to see me. It's a good life. I was like, yo, that is everything right there. You know, it means you go out and you have enough self-confidence and energy in yourself that you can help people. You have trained yourself so that you could protect those that are in need. But you've also had the ability to handle your own stuff. So when you come home, you're not bringing the stresses from work and the angers and all the things you had to deal with the extra world to your family. And now you can click the button, hit the switch, and be wholly and totally there with them, connecting to them, and be in that moment and understand that it's a good life because, man, tomorrow is not promised to any of us.
No. It's not. And I don't know if you know it or not, but my mom just died last week.
Oh my goodness.
And it brought so many things of my martial arts together. Cause she was obviously there from the beginning and huge. I have pictures of her with my instructor and she never knew his criminalities. She just thought he was that big tough guy that trained me and stuff. And she didn't know at 12 years old, he was having me do like, you know, burglaries, and he was, you know, older, he was having me like beat up guys that owed him money for drugs. She didn't know all that stuff. But she didn't have to. She did know that he made me a better person, that I have my moral compass. And let me just say something. When it comes to some of the things, shenanigans that I did younger, never after 18, I always say it was a bad guy with a bad guy, you know, a bad guy doing stuff to a bad guy. It's like, to me, I can excuse that. I really can. I loved your saying, by the way. So I'm going to look that up. But I was training Glover at the time in Connecticut, right? I'm in California. My mom's in Hawaii and my mom is 90 and I'm training with Glover. He's got a fight coming up and all of a sudden I get a call. Well, you know, your mom's not doing that good. Her friend was saying, you should come visit now. Because I was going to visit her in 2 weeks because I knew she was kind of having a hard time. So after Glover's fight, I was going to go to visit her in Hawaii with my wife. And I already had the tickets and everything. And she goes, no, I don't think you should wait the 2 weeks. I think you should get over here ASAP. And I'm over there with Glover. You know, and Glover's getting ready for his fight. But the first thing Glover said was, get over to Hawaii now, right now. He booked a flight for me that night from Connecticut to Hawaii. You know, he has a fight coming up.
Yeah.
He was worried more about me and my mom than himself. I can't even.
Oh, man, it almost brings tears to my eyes, man.
Oh, it's unbelievable. He got me a flight, him and his wife driving to the airport in New York during his training camp. I mean, in the middle of the night, he got no sleep that night. And he's more worried about me and my mom than his own UFC title, what do you call fight? You know, for the next one's contention fight. And he's more worried about me and my mom, you know? Fuck. It's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. I was on the plane just like, I'm not even believing this shit, you know? And then my wife drops everything and flies over there to meet me there. It's just that. And then seeing my mom, you know, it's just, you know, I made it in time to say goodbye and she was still awake. And then, you know, I got to do the memorial, yada, yada, yada. Just all this, it all relates to martial arts, you know? It's like, it's the family feel of martial arts. With the Glover, with the Chuck called me, apologize, you know, Chuck called me, you know, right away. He's like, he found out, he called me, and just the I don't know, the family feel you get. And then, you know, we had this predicament happen in our gym. There was a protest, which was going to be a big one, we heard. So I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I mean, this is my life. You know, this is how I give back to the community. This is how I live my life. My gym, you know. And I heard it was going to be burned down. Because they were saying they were busting people in from L.A. and Fresno. So I was like, the cops were telling me, John, you need to take this seriously. You know, this is going to be a full-on riot. And I was like, oh, shit, I never trained for a riot. I trained hundreds of guys for fights, you know, in the cage, in the ring, on the mat. But I've never trained anyone for a riot. I didn't know what to do. So I started panicking, you know. So I got my students together, my top students. So what are we going to do? And the cops, I told the cops, I have a gun and I'm going to defend my gym. And they were like, please do. This is going to be big. Well, guess what? I defended my gym. We had a guy on the roof with a gun. And the riot never happened. So it was a little protest. So I over-planned for it. So all of a sudden, everybody's calling me this, all kind of bad things, right? But I didn't know what I should do. All I kept thinking was the Koreans in the LA riots.
Right. You know? Yeah.
And I never trained for, you know, and I just wanted to protect my gym and my community. And I had told some other business owners on that street, we're going to look out for your thing. We gave out walkie-talkies. We had a walkie-talkie on the roof, and we're going to protect the community, protect our business, protect my family.
Yes, sir.
And it never came. It never came. And my part of the reason might have been they took a different path. Was because of our presence, and a lot of people think that. So either way, I realized that people in the beginning, the first couple of days, you overshot. What are you, a hater? You're this with a gun, and you know the gun guys hating people that hate the guns. They were against me. I mean, I was on the paper. I was in the news. But then like 2 days or 3 days later, it clicked the other way. And it's like, I'm the protector. I protected my community. I protected my business. I protected my family. I protected, you know, our whole community. And people were stopping me in the street and thanking me and hugging me. I had people driving into my gym that didn't want to train just to give me a hug because I'm the protector of the community. And that's what it turned into. And I realized, you know, whether somebody is jumping someone on the street or hurting my family, I'm going to protect them. And now I realize that protector, you know, it has different faces, you know, it has different weapons. Sometimes the weapon's going to be a left hook. It might be a knife, you know, it might be pepper spray. It might be, you know, it might have to be a gun. So to me, the whole thing turned into this martial arts win for me, and it clarified, you know, clarity when people were saying, you know, coming up to me, I had a person drive from a neighboring city, a family, and they came in and they hugged me and they thanked me, you know, and they said because their son's a cop, you know, and it was people like me that helped them, you know. So it meant a lot. So to me, that's what we are as martial artists.
First of all, man, I salute you. And the second thing is that I think it takes a lot of courage to go against what the cultural trance thinks all the time. And sometimes you have to act out of what you feel is right. And whether your presence there deterred them or not, or whether you were there ready. And that's the whole point, is that you took action, right? Took action, nobody got hurt, and made the place was better for it. So I salute you, sir, for that, you know. Thanks. And I think that's what it's about. Like, we have to take a stand at times to help and protect, because that's, once you protect yourself, what's the point? It's not just a selfish thing. Now hopefully you can protect other people, and protecting other people doesn't always need to be physical. It can be, hey, you just listen to them. You provide space for them to feel comfortable. You provide space for them to heal. We're creating space for this. And that's the wonderful part about all this stuff that we do, you know? And I love talking, man. I could talk to you forever. And as soon as things open up, I know I've been meaning to get down there, but I would love to get down there and train with some of your guys and get some firsthand experience from the Pitmaster. But before I let you go, I have two questions for you. Number one, for martial artists that are out there and that are listening, what's your piece of advice for them? If you could tell them one thing, what would you tell them?
Don't be a partial artist, be a martial artist, and take all of the different concepts, genres, and train them all. You can have one favorite, you know, and you can have a go-to, but you have to also have a what if. Like, you know, if somebody tries to take you down, you have to learn the takedown defense. If you're a wrestler and you love that the most, you have to learn how to defend strikes and strike as well. You have to be a full martial artist, and that includes, whether you like it or not, that includes hard interval anaerobic training. I mean, getting your heart rate way up there. That would be my first thing. Don't be a partial artist. Number two, without a doubt, never, ever, ever cheat on your girlfriend, your wife, your fiance, or your husband. Never. I don't know why, but that's a huge thing for me in martial arts. And maybe because I was terrible at that. And that's the most thing I regret in my life. Out of everything I've done, I've made some mistakes in my life. But out of all the mistakes I've made in my life, that's the biggest one that I regret, that I would take back. I wish I could take back, and I can't. Was being a disloyal, which means a douchebag and a piece of shit, husband and boyfriend to some of my exes. That's weird, huh? Because not even martial arts. I don't know why that bugs me so much.
It is, actually, it does. Right? If you think about it, because that's accountability, and it's back to the code.
Yeah.
Right? It's terrible. Back to the code. Right?
Yeah. And my instructor did. He had a live-in, and I used to go to her. You know, I always got taught back in the day, all the tough guys, you know, that's what they did. And they encouraged, and like, hey, yeah, you got this cute chick on the side, yada, yada, yada. And I used to think, yeah, I got three. Hey, how's that, you know? But when I look back at it now, that's so sleazy, and it's so low. And even if, you know, you could try to, you know, try to justify it, you know, you know, they knew that I wasn't going to be loyal to them, and they stuck around. You're still hurting them. You're still being a lowlife. And to me, as a martial artist, that's one thing. That's the one unmartial artist thing I think I did in my life. I think almost everything else I could do, I could think of, and I stuck with the code that I prepared for myself, and I expected of other people, but by me not being loyal to my exes, to me, I broke my own code, and I was less of a man because of it. And I wish, if all the things I could take back, that's the one thing.
Well, thank you for your honesty. I really appreciate that. And I wouldn't expect any less from you. You do definitely express yourself. And the last question, sir, is, this podcast is this black belt, right? What does a black belt mean to you?
I think being the not being perfect, learning from other people, that's important stuff. But I think by being the example, I think, and that's why what I just said and other ways of caring yourself, but also training yourself, showing them that you're still getting out there on the mat and pouring, you know, getting your sweat going and putting yourself into uncomfortable positions and, you know, making sure you don't ask of anything of your students that you wouldn't do yourself. Like, you know, especially in the corner, I'll use corner as a black belt. When I tell my guys in the corner, when they come back to the corner after a tough round, they know, they have the confidence of whatever I'm telling them, I've been there, and I, you know, I'm willing to do what I'm asking them or demanding they do, you know? So I think being the example and walking the walk, I guess, walking the walk, you know, is that it has nothing to do with skill, because Once I promoted guys like Chuck Liddell and Glover Teixeira, Court McGee, Ramsey Newsham, Tim Cannon, all these guys are black belt. I mean, who else is going to be that good, but they're going to be black belt? I mean, is my guy that's a pediatrician, I have a pediatrician that's a black belt, never fought a day in his life. But I consider him just as much a black belt as Chuck Liddell because he's just as good to him as Chuck is to him. You know what I mean? He's his best version of a black belt, and just like Chuck, right? So I forgot the question. Well, something about a black belt.
What does a black belt mean to you?
That's what it means. Setting the example and walking the walk.
Walking the walk. Talk the talk and walk the walk. That's as real as it gets. Thank you, thank you, thank you, sir, for being on board. I look forward to get a chance to train with you, spending more time with you. And for those listeners that are listening out there, how would they get a hold of you and find out more about your programs?
I think the best way is to go on my website. And the best way to do that is my Instagram, Pitt_Master.
Pitt_Master. There's only one.
Pitt_Master. Then you go to the bio, and then you can get to my website.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's a great honor, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much
for spending time.
I
can't wait till you come down and train with me, brother.
I can't wait.
Come up. Now you're coming up, yeah.
Now we're coming down.
Now you're coming up. And my wife's from Santa Cruz, which is
where I used to be. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I look forward to it, man. I look forward. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
All right, bro. See you guys.
Martial arts is the greatest vehicle to discover human potential. My friends, follow, like, subscribe, and share this message with the world. The Black Belt Podcast can be found on Apple, Spotify, Google, and all major broadcasting outlets. I'm your host, Harinder Singh, and always remember, wherever you go, everyone's a little bit safer. Wherever you are, anyone in need has a friend. And when you come home, they're happy to see you. It's a good life.